Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Yo, yo. When I spit bars in the rain, man, I go hard like Santan.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Cop and Fracas, powered by Touchline Media Group. I am your host, Chris, and I'm just here today to tell you that this week's episode of Cop and Fracas is proudly sponsored by our partners over at Fanslide. That's right, Fanslide is back and powering your fantasy football experience for this summer's Euros. What on earth is Fanslide, you might be asking? Well, for experienced members of the pod, you definitely know what Fanslide is, but for new listeners, we'll let you know. Fanslide is the world's first live and in-play fantasy football game with no long-term commitment, playing one-off matches that you'll be watching live anyway, with real-time updates supported by the good people from Otter. Slide players in and out when you think a strong 15 minutes is on the cards, and stack those points. But most importantly, get those players on in the key moments so you can beat your mates and claim the bragging rights in your group chat. Spice up your Euro 2020. It's funny that we're calling it Euro 2020 and not Euro 2021, just simply for branding purposes. Experience by making those boring games, and specifically looking at the Austria and Northern Macedonia game in particular. That's going to be one of the boring games you'll need to spice up. A lot more interesting with prize money on every single game, along with, I'm definitely reading this properly, but a total £10,000 prize pot. That's right. That is a £10,000 prize pot available. So you're going to want to get the spreadsheets and do all the data research for this one with all that money available. And it's a massive win-win situation for you as well. With Fanslide's extremely generous referral program, if you refer a friend from Win the App, then when they win, Fanslide will give you half. That's right, half of what they win. So there's incentives for everyone involved to refer your friends on the app. So do head over to the app store now and download Fanslide today. Fanslide, don't just watch the game, play the game. Now, we've got that out of the way. Let's just get stuck into this week's episode. So obviously, I am joined by our regulars. I've got Ellis and Peter. Gents, how are you doing on this humid evening?
All is well, sir. I am in my shorts and sandals. Feel like I'm in Lanzarote. one can dream. But yeah, I'm all right, man. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. I'm very good, like yourself, in my shorts. My slides are on. Preferably, you know, we'd like to be doing this pod in Miami, but here we are. we can dream. Next year, Cop End in Miami. We'll put that one in. We'll see if we've got the budget for that. Pete, how are you doing?
Yeah, all good. Just enjoying this weather and can't wait to get stuck into the football, really.
Good stuff, good stuff. And if you've not seen by now, if you are watching on YouTube, we are joined by the one, the only, the immortal. That's right, the immortal Paul Ghost of the Liverpool Echo. Paul, how are you doing this evening?
I'm very well, thanks, Chris. All the best for that introduction, to be honest. The immortal Paul Ghost. I think I might start calling myself that around, you know, around with my mates and stuff. Might even change the handle.
I've been watching a lot of wrestling in lockdown, and when Hulk Hogan came back, he was calling himself the immortal Hulk Hogan. So I thought, for a special guest such as yourself, I have to give you such a special name. So the immortal Paul Ghost, it is.
I think that's the first time I've been compared to the Hulkster. So I'll take that as well. You've started well so far.
Well, I mean, as ludicrous as it sounds, we've got to sweeten you up to get some information. So, you know, we got to do what we got to do.
Yeah. I know the game.
But before we do get stuck into some of the stuff, as per usual, if you are watching us on YouTube, please do hit subscribe and also hit the little bell to be alerted whenever new content goes live on the Touchline Fracas YouTube channel. And if you love what you hear from us at Cop and Fracas, we do have a Cop and Fracas Patreon page. So that is www.patreon.com/copandfracas. And from as little as £3 a month, you will get access to a wealth. And by, I definitely mean a wealth. We've got around about 100 episodes on there, both in terms of video, written, and audio content. So there's a lot of great stuff on there as well, and a lot more stuff to come. We'll have a world-famous transfer game up in the next couple of weeks, end-of-season reviews, scouting reports, and everything else in between. So that is www.patreon.com/copandfracas, and sign up today. Let's get stuck into the pod, gentlemen. And Paul, I'm going to start off with you. Been a bit of a weird year to cover football, I can assume. Want to know from your perspective, how did it feel kind of covering Liverpool games in what I've kind of referred to as pretty much soulless and empty stadiums, you know, without the roar of the crowd, kind of belling people on? And how nice was it to kind of get that let off in the Crystal Palace game with 10,000 Reds back in the stadium?
Yeah, well, you hit the nail on the head there. It very much was soulless. And it's a strange one because, you know, it's not been good at all. It's been really dreary, you know, difficult to watch, no atmosphere, feels like a training game and everything that you can kind of imagine with not being any fans in there. But you do realise that you're sitting there watching Liverpool for your living and you can't really grumble too much. So any kind of moaning that I've done has been to like colleagues or peers who I see at the game. You know, you feel like you're moaning to your mates and they're telling you to shut up because you get to watch, you know, Jürgen Klopp's Reds. So it's been a difficult one, but there's been no doubt about it. It's been really tough. I mean, the back end of last season when it all came back, it was a bit new and fresh and you knew Liverpool were going to become champions. So it wasn't really too much of a hardship. It was Liverpool champions, they've got to play the next 7 games, I think it was, and then hopefully next season we'll have fans back in, but that obviously wasn't how it turned out, and we've had an entire season without supporters in there, so it's been tough, and there's 2 games that I always think of as the main ones where you kind of think this just isn't right, and one of them is the Arsenal game in the League Cup when both teams made changes, pretty much a couple of reserve sides playing. Freezing cold, late September night, early October. Terrible game, 0-0, extra time. And then Liverpool get beat on pens. And it's like, you know, do we need to be having the League Cup in this kind of condensed season when there's going to be so many games coming thick and fast? And then the Michelin game in the Champions League at Anfield, the first one when... First Champions League game since March. And, you know, Champions League games in Anfield, they're always huge, aren't they? Massive events and... you know, with kind of folklore under the lights, you know, night games and stuff. And with respect to Mitchell and the playing the team who you don't really know too much about, and again, it's freezing cold, there's no fans in there, the game's pretty dull and dreary, and Liverpool get over the line, and it's all a bit like, is this it? Is this what it's come to? You know, so it's been really difficult, but there was the silver lining of the 10,000 fans for the Palace game, and that was great. I was looking forward to that for weeks, even when it didn't even look as if Liverpool were going to have anything riding on it. So that was a little bit of a kind of toe in the water for what hopefully it will be like in August, September and onwards. And hopefully we can get back to some sort of normality next season.
Hopefully so. I mean, obviously we just need that atmosphere kind of back in the stadiums, mm-hmm. really. And Els, I'll come to you with this question, kind of following up from what Paul said there. Do you see a full season with fans back in the ground, you know, in some capacity? Do you think it's going to be a big help for players who've kind of had seemingly down seasons in compared to, you know, their previous years? I'm still kind of looking at kind of Roberto Firmino and Sadio Mane in prime examples. You know, Roberto Firmino kind of placed the crowd, really. You see it, you know, in the start of play, the flicks, the effort. And of course, Sadio Mane with just his relentless work rate, really, kind of buoyed on by the crowd as well. Do you see fans being back in the stadium as a bit of a boost to them and hopefully kind of give them a bit more of a kick up the arse that they need next season, to put it lightly?
Yeah, at first I didn't really hold any water to that. I used to think these are footballers, these are what they need to do. But that extra motivation with like 50,000 people cheering you on and allowing you to get that extra 10% is very, very important. And players like Firmino and Mane will probably benefit from that. Us as humans, we need that extra motivation. Remember, you know, sports day, your mum and that shouting you on, yeah, go on, do it. Obviously, I used to win all the time, so it didn't really matter to me, innit? But,
well, to be fair, I saw your gym video yesterday, and you are indeed built different. So that is that's a fact.
But yeah, that extra motivation is very, very handy, and it does come in times. And we've seen it with Liverpool. I know Pete will say Barcelona when we've beaten them 4-0. The crowd was phenomenal that day. Games gone past. I know this week we're celebrating 2001. There's games there. Barcelona, and we've beaten them in the semi-final. So the crowd's always important because it gives you that, as I said, extra 10% when your body can't take it, but then you just have that extra win from somewhere. So I'm sure when the fans come back in full capacity, we'll see those kind of players go up a notch.
There's even little instances as well, and I think you've hit the nail on the head there exactly, Els, in terms of the player performances. But I think in terms of in-game events, really, I kind of go back to the Burnley game. Divock Origi's through one-on-one with a goal, and he seemingly clips the... Did he hit the crossbar or did he hit the post? Can't remember now. I just remember my head being in my hands thinking, I can't believe he's missed. Hit the crossbar. And it's just the roar of the stadium, the energy, the ground, that mythical place of Anfield just generates. That sucks the ball into the net. And again, the other game I'll kind of refer to is the Real Madrid game at home in the quarterfinals. I think with the crowd there, you see a bit more energy, a bit more roar in the team, a bit more tempo, a bit more speed, and more than likely Liverpool possibly win that game. But thankfully, we're back in the competition for next year, so we can definitely find out. Pete, I'm going to come to you on this question. It's a bit of a, you know, this is something that we always speak about quite vocally on, not only as Coppen, but as Touchline as the network. Past two England friendlies. International football is not my cup of tea. I don't think I actually knew all the teams that qualified for the Euros until this week, in all honesty. But in these England friendlies, we've seen pretty much a large section of idiots who've been booing the players taking a knee. You know, obviously Gareth Southgate's come out and kind of explained the players' positions. The players have come out as well, specifically Jordan Henderson on the position and what it represents. How are people still not understanding the full aspect of what this act really represents, and the players' kind of viewpoint behind it?
I think the main aspect of that is that people, they don't want to understand, so that's how they're not understanding. You know what I'm saying? They don't want to open up their mind to kind of like what the players, the message that it's bringing and stuff like that. I think people are giving kind of like a shoddy excuse of, I don't agree with the Black Lives Matter as an organisation or this and that, but you agree with everyone being equal, don't you? You know what I'm saying? So if you agree with just the simple message of everyone being equal, then why shouldn't you like be with people taking a knee and people stand up for equality? You know what I'm saying? It doesn't matter what the organisation is doing or whatever, you should be with everyone being treated equal and kind of giving a message. And that knee, they've been doing it for what, 12 over, like let's say like over a year now, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So if you don't get the message now, then you're never going to get it, and you don't want to get, you know what I'm saying? I think we should probably just focus on the majority that are kind of like accepting it and trying to like change. And because I think there was a large part of the crowd that did clap as well, so they tried to like kind of clap over the booze. So yeah, I think we just kind of have to ignore those people that don't want to get and not willing to get it. So yeah, nothing really we can do about it, but just keep going and keep trying to change the narrative, hopefully.
No, I completely agree. And I think the whole point of the knee is to kind of educate a younger audience as well. You know, teenagers, people kind of going into their 20s about these issues, people who are still open to kind of learn about these things and being on the right side of history, as opposed to kind of the older generation who are kind of very much stuck in their ways and will boo this because they see it as a political statement, which it pretty much isn't, in all honesty. Paul, I'll come to you kind of on the same question as well. We saw Liverpool kind of take a very strong lead on this kind of towards the back end of last season. Obviously, there's that iconic picture of all the team and the backroom staff around the centre circle at Anfield kind of taking the knee, and that was strongly led by Trent Alexander-Arnold and Jordan Henderson. Do you know whether the club have kind of got like a contingency plan in place just in case there are boos for kind of next season? And can you talk about the role that some of the lads in the squad have played in terms of amplifying their voice in supporting this issue?
Yeah, well, when all the players took the knee last year at Anfield, funnily enough, that was just by chance that they were at Anfield that day. They had a practice game at Anfield, and they just had two teams, you know, 22 players kind of preparing for when the football was coming back. But it was Van Dijk and Wijnaldum actually who had seen what had been going on with George Floyd and the protesting in Minneapolis and Memphis, and I think it was Los Angeles. I think there was three nights of protests across America, and Van Dijk and Wijnaldum got together. They spoke with Henderson and Milner because they're the kind of quartet of captains, if you like. They're the leadership committee in the Liverpool squad. And they basically come up with this idea and put it to the rest of the squad and said, look, do you want to take the knee in the centre circle and we can get a club photographer to get a picture of it, and we can all put it out and show that we are behind this Black Lives Matter movement. And unanimously, the squad were in agreement. So all the players did it. And Henderson, someone was telling me actually earlier this week, that Henderson spoke to Jürgen, and he said, look, this is what we're planning to do. He wasn't asking for permission, almost just like a heads up. And the manager was saying, yeah, fully behind it, fully support it, as do the staff. But the players were keen for it to be just the team, just the players, the athletes, because I think at the time, Jadon Sancho had you know, lifted up a thing for George Floyd when he'd scored a couple of days earlier. And I think there was plenty of you know, NBA players and NFL players speaking out at the time. So Liverpool were keen to make sure that they were heard as well. So they did that. Obviously, the club photographer got an incredible picture of them all in the home and away kits around the centre circle, taking the knee. Unity is strength, and that was the message. And it was very much a collective message from everyone in the Liverpool squad that they were fully behind everyone who was fighting against injustice and inequality. And that's what the England players are doing, isn't it? Now it's not hard to understand, and I completely agree with you, Peter. You know, people who willfully ignorant towards it and claim it's for certain political movements and Marxist ideology and all that, it isn't. They just want to boo it because they don't agree with it. It's heartbreaking, to be honest, but hopefully it is just a minority of football fans who think that way. And to your question, Chris, about have Liverpool got a contingency plan in place, I don't think they have, because the majority of the fan base, the Liverpool fan base, are of the same viewpoint, the same way that the Rush 4 are here, the same way that the Liverpool squad is, the same way that pretty much everyone inside the Liverpool bubble is. So I don't think there is any plan in place for any booing of the knees, because at Anfield, I don't think we'll ever hear it.
No, that's the exact answer I was hoping to hear, and I've expected to hear as well. I mean, kind of you look at Liverpool, the city, Liverpool, the club, and everything it stands for in terms of, you know, the socialism, like you said, unity is strength. We are, you know, stronger together as one. Literally what we saw again in terms of protests against the European Super League as well. It's just personified in everything that Liverpool does as a unit and as a collective, really. So no, that's really good stuff to hear. Let's shift the conversation towards Liverpool's season performance. It's a little bit of a cringe-worthy thing for some people to talk about, but thankfully, it all ended on a very good note. So I just want to do a quick round robin, and Pete, I'll start with you. Given all the mitigating factors, what would you rate this season out of 10 for Liverpool?
That's a good question. I think overall, I'd probably have to go with a 6. And I'll go with a six because, like, I know we ended it well, but no season without a trophy for me or without, like, a first place finish, you know what I'm saying, deserves more than, like, an eight or nine. It's not, like, a great season, you know what I'm saying? So we definitely started off well. We looked like we was favourites with the signings of Thiago and Jota. And I was quite confident, to be honest, when we got them. And Jota comes in on fire. Thiago has a great performance against Chelsea. And you're thinking, like, wow. Man City are just crumbling as well. Pep looks like he's lost his mind. And yeah, we look unstoppable. And then Merseyside derby comes. Pickford, you know what I'm saying? I don't know what he was trying to do with Van Dijk, but yeah, he kind of just crushes him and our season just goes down from there. So we have the six home defeats. I think that definitely doesn't happen without fans, by the way. That definitely doesn't happen without fans. But yeah, we had the six home defeats, and that period from it's about like what, February or January to like March, April. Yeah, it's just such a bad period for us. And then we kind of end it well. So all things considering, I think we've done well with what we had. So we start to put centre back. So we had Nat Phillips and Reece Williams and Quebec. They done well to cover. We put Fabinho in there and then Thiago start to play well with him. We went on a great run last 10 games in 8 wins, 2 draws. We done well there. But I think all things considered, I have to give it a 6, to be honest, because I look at us as a super club and I look at us as one of the biggest clubs in the world. And at the end of the day, I want to win trophies. I want to win the biggest things. So I can only get really, I have to cap it at a 6.
He's right. Els, about you?
Yeah,
I feel same. Like you'll be a bit more generous. Nah. Really?
Yeah, same. I was going to give it a 6. I just thought, I think we had enough to do what better than what we've done. I know, yeah, Phillips and Williams weren't as good as anyone else, but I still believe that the squad as a whole, I still believe that we should have pushed at least for that second place a bit more. Had we got second with the mitigating factors of losing the three centre-backs, I would have given it like a 7 or something. I personally believe that we had enough in us because when you look at the landscape of the whole league, it wasn't really that good. Even Man City running away with the title, they've only finished 5 points more than what they had last season. Even with the Super Diaz and this, that and the third.
Super Diaz.
Yeah, can you really say that they were like, they had a really good spell? So in the middle where we had a really bad spell, they had a really good spell and they won every single game.
Yeah.
That was really the toss up of it. I still believe Liverpool had enough within the squad to do better. So maybe I'll probably give them a 6.5 just because of the way they ended. But yeah, I don't know. Yeah, 6.5 for me, man.
Sprinkling a little 0.5 on there with like parsley on the end of a good meal, where we love to see it. Paul, how about yourself? What would you give the season out of 10?
Well, when I was reading the kind of itinerary before, I was thinking maybe an 8, just because of how difficult the circumstances were. Liverpool were without Van Dijk, Gomez, Mata played the most out of those three, and he played 10 times in the Premier League.
Yeah.
Liverpool finished the season with Nat Phillips and Reece Williams at centre-back for the last 5-6 games. And if you'd have said that in August, you'd have been thinking, what has gone wrong here? And you know, a lot. Ben Davis and Quebec missed the last month themselves with injuries. And it wasn't just the centre-backs, was it? Thiago was out for 3 months, Jota 3 months, Fabinho a month, Trent a month. Alisson missed a fair few games. The only players who weren't really injured were Wijnaldum, Robertson and Firmino. I can see what you're saying about Liverpool on a super club, and Liverpool exists to win trophies, and they didn't get near any of them that did early. So I downgraded it to a 7. And that's probably about right. Somehow they managed to finish third. They were chasing fourth and they finished third. Superb end to the season, but those 6 games where they lost 6 on the bounce at Anfield was just never known anything like it. And as you say, that wouldn't happen if fans were in there. When Mohamed Salah equalises against City with 25 minutes to go, 54,000 fans are in there. Liverpool are probably going to win that, don't they? They don't lose against Fulham. They don't lose against Brighton. They don't lose against Burnley. Probably don't lose against Everton. But yeah, I mean, we can't. I mean, all's well that ends well, I guess, and they are in the Champions League. But 8 was probably pushing it a bit, so 7.
Nice effect there. 6, 6.5 and a 7. But I think the one thing we can all agree on is it's absolutely hilarious that this Liverpool team somehow managed to finish 3rd, given all the factors that were stacked against them. Every time I think about it, it's just hilarious.
Absolutely
kicked. I spent a good 10 minutes laughing manically at the joke after the season finished. Like,
on that Sunday, I spent 10 minutes laughing. Like, why are we 3rd? What's happening here?
You'd love to see it. I want to touch on something Paul said there as well, focusing on Mo Salah. And, you know, obviously a bit of a lull season for the Reds, as we've said by the grades we've given. Mo Salah was one of the players who did kind of stand tall, again, hitting the heights of his goals and some of his fantastic performances, and shone throughout. Paul, actually, I'll start off with you with this one. We kind of see that with opposition supporters specifically and some section of the mainstream media that Mohamed Salah is still kind of criminally disrespected as a footballer, as an elite level footballer. Why do you think that is?
Honestly, I don't know. But I don't think he's the only one, because you look at Harry Kane there, he's just won the Golden Boot and the assist king or whatever they call that, and he hasn't got anywhere near player of the year, has he? So he's not the only one. But you know what? It doesn't actually bother me too much. I mean, Liverpool supporters know how good Mohamed Salah is. People who cover the club closely know how good Mohamed Salah is. He's unbelievable, and when he finally does leave Liverpool, he's going to go down as one of the greatest ever players. And you know, you don't say that lightly, do you? He scored 120 goals, 20 odd goals or something in 4 seasons. It's just a remarkable footballer, yeah. And I do think that he does get overlooked. I'm not too sure why that is, but I don't think. It's probably a good thing for Liverpool supporters, for them to just kind of go under the radar and stay out of the best player in the world conversations, because Liverpool know how good he is and they can just kind of crack on. I remember asking Klopp a similar question. I said, why do you think he goes under the radar? And he said, well, he doesn't for us, so I'm not sure he does. And that pretty much summed it up. I mean, I suppose that's probably the best way for Liverpool fans to go about it. You know, they know he's world class, so... if other teams don't, so what?
Fantastic answer. As long as he kind of creeps under the radar from some of the bigger teams, it's all in Liverpool's benefit, really. Pete, I'll come to you as well on that same question, kind of following off from what Paul said there. Why do you think Mohamed Salah is still kind of criminally disrespected? I mean, we see it kind of every day, really, on the timeline and stuff, that he's very well disrespected in terms of the elite tackers, not only in the Premier League, but in the Premier League as well. Some people have quoted that Riyad Mahrez is a better footballer than Mohamed Salah. What do you think drives this kind of weird disrespect of one of the best footballers we've seen in Liverpool shirt?
Yeah, I think it's strange because he's a player that does divide opinion, and I don't know why he divides opinion. Like, just look at his record, look at what he's done for the club, like the amount of goals he scored. Like, it's crazy. Like, he, you know what I'm saying, he's a certified goal scorer. He gets you goals no matter the weather, no matter the season, no matter the players around him. And if he, even if you ask our fan base, you have some of our fan base, so we'll say, yeah, Salah's good, but he's not. You know what I'm saying? He didn't play well this game. He hasn't got the best dribbling. He doesn't go past this player like that. He's a bit clumsy. And I just think that's really strange to me, because, like, we're talking about getting these players in. So maybe people talk about getting Mbappe's in, your, I don't know, Sancho's in. We've got a player right here who literally gets you goals. You know what I'm saying? He will get you goals, assists. And he's superb. Like, he's an absolute superstar. And I think, like Paul said, we won't really appreciate him until he kind of goals. So, yeah, I'm not too sure. I think maybe one of the reasons is the first season he had. So the first season where he scores so many goals, I think people kind of expected him to kind of keep going at that sort of unsustainable rate, which was never sustainable, you know what I'm saying? So it's funny, because if he had a career where his career was reverse order, so if he got that season, if he had it now, I think people would rate him more. So he's kind of a victim of his own success in a weird way. So I think that first season really kind of set him up for criticism. But yeah, regardless, he's still a top player, and I'm just grateful that we have him.
No, 100%.
Yeah. Sorry, Chris, I'm just about to say, I was going to make that exact point. If Salah's numbers are reversed, if he just finished this season with 44 and he's got 31 in his first season, and you know, 22 and 24, whatever it is in between, people will be looking at him thinking, you know, this lad is one of the world's best. So it's strange, isn't it? But that's just the way it is.
Yeah, it really is. It's crazy how we analyse footballers like this. We kind of don't take the consistency into account. We always kind of go for that one red hot kind of anomaly season, but it's just Salah's best season, and he's kind of stayed at that level, which is just absolutely fantastic, really. No one would have thought we were getting this kind of player when we signed him from Roma all those years ago. Els, I'll come to you on this one. One name answer, please, for this. I feel like we're all going to be quite unison in who this player is going to be. Who's your surprise package from this season? So who's the player that stood out the most to you, who you didn't expect to kind of be very impressed by?
It's going to have to be Phillips, isn't it? It's going to have to be. I know you want to one word, but I'm sorry, I'm going to have to say a few more.
No, go on. as long as we're all in agreement that it is Nat Phillips.
Nat Phillips, if we're going to keep it 100, I don't want to be disrespectful to him, but he's capped at a limit in comparison to what we have. He knows what he's good at, and he tries and stays within that. And he made a big difference. The two games he didn't play in the last 10, Leeds and Newcastle, he was actually missed. I remember I was saying, Chris, like, I actually missed him, because the two goals that we did concede, had he been there, he would have cleared lines. Like, he's somebody that he's a pure old school British defender who just thinks about clearing his lines first and worries about everything else after. He's not here to play football, even though he does play football. He's just here to just get rid of it and sort out the defence. And to be fair to him, he took the mantle and he took it upon himself to like do his job, and he done his job well. And yeah, I was kind of astonished. He was a decent player. Like, even when he had the cameos, the FA Cup game against Everton, he came in with Gomez and he done well there. So you can always see that maybe the level at Liverpool was too high. And that's no shame in saying, there's nothing wrong in saying that we are at a ridiculous level at the minute. So So for him to come in and just to like help Liverpool when we really needed help was a big testament to him. So yeah, I'm going to go for Nat Phillips.
Paul, I'll come to you on this next part. Obviously, there's a really good piece by your colleague Theo over at the Liverpool Echo, obviously focused on Nat Phillips. And I think we quickly forget that last October he was very much on the verge of a move away from Anfield. How, you know, kind of talk about butterfly flex and sliding doors moment. Thank God that didn't happen, because he's come out so clutch in this season, and he's really done everything in his remit, in his ability, like Elsa said, to kind of really nail down a spot in this Liverpool team for next year as well.
Yeah, 100%. As Elsa said there, he's a defender's defender, isn't he? He gets his head in there. He likes to get his tackles in, his blocks in, and he doesn't do a whole lot more. He doesn't really need to. He's not particularly mobile. He's not the quickest. He's not, he's not Van Dijk with the ball at his feet, but
he's one of those centre backs. Sorry to interrupt you, Paul. He's one of those centre backs where your dad watches football and he goes, "That's a footballer."
Yeah. He's a dad's defender.
That's a good way. He's your dad's defender.
And him, he's a throwback. Yeah, that's exactly what he is. Yeah, no ways or graces to him. Just an absolute defender, a warrior, and he really stood up and was counted this season. And yeah, you rightly pointed to Theo's piece. I think Theo was able to get him on a Zoom chat whenever it was, quite recently, and he was telling him about how he nearly left. I think it was Bristol City at the time that were interested, and his bags were packed in the car, and he was on his way, and didn't quite work out, did it? And thank Liverpool's lucky stars that it didn't, because you wonder who they were going to be picking if they didn't have Nat Phillips on hand. And as we said there, the two games that he didn't win in that 10-game run were when he wasn't in the team. And if you look at the goals, you can see that specifically one was a corner, wasn't it? Headed inside the 16 box against Leeds. And another one was a Was it Joe Willock who profited from a knockdown? You know, you kind of think if that had been put in the air, then Matt Phillips is attacking that all day long, and Liverpool have got 6 points instead of two. So, he's certainly kind of given himself a shot at having a tough-like career there. Whether it's at Liverpool, I think the power now is in his hands. I think Klopp will be desperate to keep him. Obviously, they just signed Canate, and he'll have Van Dijk, Gomez and Matip back at some point. But I think Klopp quite likes him. I think he sees a little bit of himself in him, actually. You know, a bit of a rugged, durable defender who was not blessed with, you know, ball-playing abilities, but has made a career for himself. So if he's got suitors in the top flight, you know, I look at Burnley and think he'd be absolutely ideal for a team like that. If he's got,
it's weird that we always deflect to Burnley think about potential destinations for Nat Phillips.
It's just because of the way they defend, don't they? On their own 6 yard box to get the runners in, the tackles in, the blocks, and that's Nat Phillips to a T. So if he's got, I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't have someone interested, and then the power's up to him. If he wants to go and make a career for himself somewhere else in the Premier League, he'll go with a massive, massive pat on the back.
What do you think in terms of valuation would have to be met for him to potentially leave?
Good question. Well, I think the way Liverpool work with their valuations is, I mean, sometimes people think that Michael Edwards is some sort of mythical guru, but it's very much based on market prices. So they got 22 million for Ryan Brewster last summer because of Ollie Watkins going to Aston Villa. Ollie Watkins was smashing it with Brentford. I think he was top scorer in the Championship, and Liverpool looked at Brewster and he scored 11 goals in 22 games for Swansea and thought, well, that's fairly compatible. Okay. So we won X amount of money for him. And they did something similar with Taiwo Awoniyi. I can never say his name. Awoniyi. A couple of years ago, there was interest from clubs in Belgium, and I think he'd just been on loan in Belgium, and he scored a similar amount to Wesley. I think Wesley had gone to Aston Villa that same summer. I think Liverpool looked at it and think, well, he's gone for 20-odd million, so we're asking for 15 for our guy. So it's very much based on market prices. So I suppose a valuation for Nat Phillips would come if there's another kind of centre-back departure this summer in the Premier League. For me, I think you'd be looking at somewhere between 10 and 15 million now for Nat Phillips. 20-odd games for Liverpool last season. This is a team that finished third in the Premier League after all. So I wouldn't be giving them away if I was Liverpool.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that's a really interesting tidbit as well about obviously how they kind of benchmarked Ryan Brewster against Ollie Watkins with valuation there. Definitely didn't know that, so that's going to be interesting. And especially for a 1 year as well. He's had a fairly decent season in Germany for Union Berlin. I got corrected by Chris Williams, Bundesliga correspondent, on the pronunciation of that, so I have to do it as Union Berlin and not Union Berlin. It'd be interesting to see what the comparison for that one will be in terms of Bundesliga. Obviously, we know the Premier League clubs do have an interest in Bundesliga strikers. Paul, another question for you, Colin, before we end this one quick section. We've obviously discussed the intensity and the grit that, you know, the lad showed towards the end of that season, going on that 10-game unbeaten streak to close it out. Do you think Klopp and the players can kind of really frame this as great motivation to use throughout pre-season to really ensure they hit the ground running and get back to the heights that not only them as players, but, well, not only us as fans, but them as players are really accustomed to?
Yeah, I think there'll be a determination in the squad this summer to really kind of put up a better fight than they did last season for the title. I think they'll know that these injuries is a bit of a freak season, and if it doesn't happen again, then they've got every chance of matching City next season for the title. And I think a good pre-season is needed. And I was looking at the squads for the Euros, and there's actually not too many who are going. Thiago's obviously there, Jota, obviously Henderson's going, but aside from that, you know, there's not too many. The front three, obviously African and South American, Fabinho, South American, Alisson, Brazilian. Nico Williams is going, but okay, he doesn't play every week, does he?
And the game time will do him the world of good as well.
Yeah, I think so, particularly for him. He hasn't played much, has he? But generally, I think Liverpool are going to be having fairly strong complement of players when they resume training on the 12th of July, and then over the next couple of weeks, you know, inching towards August, they'll have most of them back. So I think if they get a solid pre-season under the belt, they can really hit the ground running for next season. And I think they will have something of a point to prove once they get players fit and ready, and they'll be flying.
No, I love it. Revenge tour, the revenge season, yeah. The Liverpool Football Club revenge season for next year. Hopefully they come out all guns blazing. Let's move on to talk about, I guess he's now former Liverpool midfielder, Jorginho Wijnaldum. Peter, I'm going to come to you on this as you are his biggest fan. I'm thinking of the Davido video where he goes, fan love. That is definitely you with Ginny. Don't worry. Actually, let us know when your birthday is and we'll get you a PSG shirt with his with his name on the back. Obviously, from there, really, it now appears and it seemingly confirmed by Fabrizio Romano that he's now heading to Paris Saint-Germain on a fairly sizable contract. I think is it 4 years? And after tax, he'll be earning about 160,000 a week. So he's pretty much doubled his salary from what he was earning at Liverpool. With a club like PSG and a manager such as Pochettino, very much driven to kind of make a really big investment of a player of his calibre and of his age, do you now think it's a bigger mistake for Liverpool letting him walk?
So in terms of Gini Wijnaldum, like, everyone knows that I'm a big fan of him, and it's just because of how reliable he is. And I'll say every week, like, he's one of Jurgen Klopp's most trusted soldiers. Like, honestly, he's one of the first names on the team sheet always. Like, Klopp always trusts him with a game plan. When it comes to the big games, he's always on the team sheet. You know what I'm saying? If he's not, then he's the first sub to come off the bench and score two goals. You know what I'm saying? So I think that no matter how the season plays out, there's going to be a couple of games this season where we're going to be like, I miss Gini Wijnaldum. You know what I'm saying? Because, like, his durability and the way he's been able to be available every game, it's really, really key for us. So, like, in all honesty, I actually think that if you want me to be totally honest, I think Klopp has actually tried to kind of not maybe edge him out the side. So maybe in terms of like buying people like Keita, he's tried to go to like a more centralized style of football, Oxlade-Chamberlain. And then what normally happens is that they're not reliable. They're not as reliable as a Gini Wijnaldum, and Gini Wijnaldum always ends up back in the side. You know what I'm saying? So, like, he's literally, so we always go back to having Gini Wijnaldum in the midfield. So my kind of concern is that how do we look like without Gini Wijnaldum? How does our midfield look like when maybe Henderson is getting a bit older, he's getting a little bit more knocks, Milner, he's obviously, you know what I'm saying, he can't go on forever, bless him, you know what I'm saying, what a guy, but he can't literally play on until, you know what I'm saying, so even like Thiago, he's notoriously known for not completing seasons, you know what I'm saying, fully, you know what I'm saying, so we have a lot of midfielders that might take a bit of like knocks and injuries, obviously not to mention KR and Chamberlain. So how does our midfield kind of look like without Gini Wijnaldum? And hopefully it can look like maybe someone like Curtis Jones getting more game time. I don't know if we'll get a replacement in, but yeah, I'm a little bit concerned, to be honest, of how we might look like without Gini.
Yeah, and also going on for that point, Pete. Paul, you made a suggestion saying that with the captaincy in regards to taking a knee, you were talking about how Gini and Van Dijk were leading that. We know that Gini is the fourth captain in the squad. Who do you think will take over that mantle? Because he is someone that does grant a lot of respect, and he's a big leader. He's not really a talker, but he's more of a guy who goes out there and does what he needs to do, and leads by example. Who do you think will take over that mantle?
It's a good question, actually. I haven't thought about it too much, but in terms of the way the kind of makeup of the squad is, I think they will look to promote someone, you know, just when things need discussing as a group. As we mentioned with the whole taking a knee thing, it was those four who kind of knocked their heads together to come up with the plan. I mean, Klopp's always been, I mean, he's never been too concerned with who's captain is in any given game, if that makes sense. He's obviously got his club captain in Jordan Henderson and the vice captain in Milner, but, you know, he's given the captain's armband to whoever's been there the longest. And when you give it to Trent instead of Salah or however, what that, you know, with Mitchell and Salah kind of took that as a bit of his nose out of joint, didn't he? And Klopp admitted that it was a mistake because he probably should have given it to Origi because Origi had been there the longest and he just didn't really think about it, you know, with all the, you know, the things you've got to worry about during a game. So I'm not sure who's going to be getting promoted to that fourth man. It's a very good question. Do you think Trent might step up? He's only 22, but he's been in the first team now for 3 years or so. He's always had designs on eventually being Liverpool captain, so potentially he could be one of them.
Firmino was the captain of the game against West Brom, so, and he's been there the longest. So, if we're going by order of rank and kind of he's been there longest, so it would probably be with Firmino. But my personal opinion, I think it probably should be Salah. So Salah's influence on the team, being the goal scorer, being like, and he's the captain of Egypt as well. I think it should probably go to Salah. But I don't know whether it will or not.
And I think towards the end of the season, he was really taking that mantle. He was really really pushing the team. He was celebrating all the goals. He was destroying when he conceded. Even against Man United, you can see how much it meant to him to have that captain's armband, him scoring that last goal. So I think he was really priming himself for that role. And I think we should really give it to him, to be fair.
Yeah, I think he's probably got the biggest claim to it, hasn't he, now after 4 superb years to kind of step into that role as the one of the 4 men.
No, yeah, I definitely feel the same, to be fair. It'd be interesting to see Trent obviously put in that position. I think a bit of a dark horse candidate possibly could be maybe Curtis Jones. You always see him kind of with his leadership abilities and how vocal he is. That'd be quite interesting. I think he might be a little bit too young for that mantle, but it'd be definitely interesting to see.
I was just gonna ask you before we move on. So, do you think that we're gonna get a signing in to kind of replace Genie, or you think someone's gonna step up in terms of like Curtis? Or,
well, everything that I'm getting told at the moment is that the focus is very much on the contracts in July. So it's Binho and Alisson are kind of front and centre for that when they come back to training, and they're going to try and get Van Dijk, Salah, Trent and Robertson tied down to contracts, and that's very much the focus at the moment. But Wijnaldum played 51 times last season, so to just discard that without getting a replacement in is bonkers, I think. I mean, we know that there are other players in there who can step up on any given game, but after 3 seasons of so many different little niggling injuries and so on, are you going to trust Naby Keita to play 30 games a season? Oxlade-Chamberlain. Milner, we know, is 35. He'll be 36 in January, I think. So it's a big task for Fabinho, Henderson and Thiago to stay fit throughout the season. And let's face it, Henderson, he kind of escapes it a little bit, but he's had his fair share of injuries over the years, and so has Thiago. So, for me, it's Liverpool have to get a central midfielder this summer, but everything I'm hearing at the moment is that the contracts are the focus, and then see what they can do. But for me, they've got to get a centre mid in.
Do you think they changed the shape? Oh, sorry, go on.
Go on, Els.
Yeah. Do you think they changed the shape because where we had that, we had Genie there, we was really regimented in a 3 in the middle. So obviously, when you have 3 midfielders, you have like 3 less. But then you're now taking Genie away. Do you think we can go to like a 2 in the middle, where we'll have Thiago and Hendo swapping roles? So obviously, Fabinho will be the mainstay, but then you have Thiago next to him one game, and then Hendo next to him the other game. So that will keep them fresh. Do you think that could happen?
Yeah, they've definitely got the ability to do it, haven't they? But Liverpool didn't play that much last season, and I know they played it at Manchester City, didn't they, the 4-2-3-1, and it was very bold actually going with Jota, Firmino, Salah and Mane, and it worked for the best part of 40 minutes. Liverpool eventually ran out of energy in the second half, and both teams were happy to settle for a point. And I think it was at Newcastle the other game when they used it, and they created a half full of chances, didn't they? Mane missed the sitter, Salah missed a couple, and on another day, Liverpool would have won that game quite comfortably. So it's an exciting prospect, isn't it, to think that in certain games they can go with the 2 and the 4 up front, essentially, and just look to blow teams away. So maybe Klopp is thinking that he can use that a little bit more next season. But for me, as I say, I mean, just for the players so durable and so reliable as Wijnaldum, to kind of just toss that aside without the replacements is a bit, you know, a bit mad for me.
It is a bit reckless, and I want to know your opinion, Paul. Obviously, not what you're hearing in terms of, you know, potential rumblings from whoever it may be. But in your opinion, who should be kind of the person or the profile of player that Liverpool should look to bring in as the Wijnaldum replacement this summer?
Good question. Wijnaldum is almost the Swiss Army knife in midfield, isn't he? He can play as a 6, an 8, as a 10. He's played at centre back. He's played up front in the Champions League semi final against Barcelona. So he's pretty much got the perfect skill set to be in a Klopp midfield. Works so hard, shields the ball better than anyone really, and that is going to be hard to replicate. Bissouma seems to be the one at the moment, doesn't he, that people are clamouring for. Every time I've seen him at Brighton, haven't made a habit of watching Brighton, but whenever I have seen him, he always looks like he's a player with plenty of potential and plenty of ability. So he could be one, but it's difficult, isn't it? You know, making that step up to playing in a Jürgen Klopp midfield. It's probably one of the most difficult jobs in world football, I'd suggest. So Liverpool are going to have to choose carefully, you know, who's going to be the one to come in. But everything I've seen of Bissouma suggests that he would be at least a passable replacement for me.
No, I think that's really key what you said there. I think being in a Jurgen Klopp midfield is one of the most difficult jobs in football. And I think it's one of the most thankless jobs in football as well. And we've definitely seen it with Wijnaldum. We've seen some section of the fan base kind of happy that he's leaving, and obviously a large section obviously disappointed that he's leaving. So it's weird that your players can be divided in this manner. So let's move on to the next section that we're going to talk about. And I think it's the one, especially at this time of year, is what everyone wants to hear about. It's what gets the streets rumbling, the transfer talk. And Paul, I'm obviously going to start off with yourself. You had a really good piece on The Echo in terms of potential outgoings at LFC as opposed to incomings. What do you see the outlook being like for guys such as, you know, Marco Gruic, Yoji Kiri, and Divock Origi? What type of offers are potentially on the table for these players? And do you see them leaving Liverpool this summer?
I see Marco Gruic leaving, yeah, at this point now. We had a story on the Echo website on Sunday, I think. I was off. It was my colleague Ian Doyle. He'd spoken to one or two people around the club, and what the suggestion was the Porto were looking to actively make a move for Gruic. Liverpool were inundated with messages earlier in the season. So after the Juventus game in the Champions League, I think there was teams from Germany and Italy getting in touch with Liverpool. And at the time, what Liverpool were keen to stress was they're not making a decision yet. They want to speak to Porto when the season's over and kind of respect them to pause any kind of negotiations until Porto were given almost first refusal. I mean, I'm not sure that was in the loan contract, but Liverpool kind of were courteous enough to speak to Porto first. And it does seem though Porto are interested, so they're looking to kind of move one or two around at the moment before they can finance a move for Gruic. But I think Liverpool view him quite highly. Actually, is he 25 now? He's played less than 20 games for Liverpool, and he was Jürgen Klopp's first sign. And so if you've been here 5 years and you're still not a regular, the writing is probably on the wall. But Liverpool will look for, you know, a decent fee for him that will hopefully be replenished into the transfer kitty, and I do see Gruic leaving. Origi, yeah, I think this might be his final few weeks at Liverpool. It's been a strange career, hasn't it? You know, loans at Lille and Wolfsburg, and winning goals in the Champions League final, and goals against Barcelona in the Champions League final. So many goals seemingly against Everton. He's had a really strange career of ups and downs at Liverpool, but I think he may finally be heading for the exit door. And Shaqiri, yeah, Shaqiri decided to stay actually in October. He had interest in January of 2020 from Sevilla and Roma. And I think Klopp at the time was keen to say, we're about 3 months away from winning the Premier League, so it's all hands on deck and we're not going to risk anything that might derail this, so stay put for now. And then in the autumn with the new kind of dates of the transfer window, I think there was interest from couple of teams in Italy, and that was why he was left out of the Arsenal game in the League Cup. by Harry Wilson starting in his place. But in the end, he chose to stay. And I think he'd probably be looking at his career now. I think he's 29, and he might be thinking, it's time for him to go and play regularly for the last few years of his career as well. So, yeah, those three players you mentioned, actually, I think they're probably all heading for the exit door this summer.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. You mentioned Harry Wilson there as well. What's kind of the current situation with him? Obviously, had a very good end to that loan spell at Cardiff. You know, scored a brilliant hat trick and performed really well alongside kind of Shay Ojo as well. Do you see him potentially leaving? Obviously, he's kind of getting to that 25 age range now, where he kind of needs to kick on and kind of really kind of settle down in one place and build his career up, as opposed to having loan moves. Do you think he'll probably be seeing the exit door to Pastors New this summer?
Yeah, I do. He's another one. I think he would have left for Burnley last summer. Only the two teams couldn't agree a fee. I think Liverpool were looking for around about 15 million for him, and Burnley were looking for something closer to 10, and there was no agreement. And he basically went back to Wales quite late towards the end of the transfer window, just because he needed to be out there playing, and obviously it suited him being back in his homeland. So I think this summer, again, I don't think Liverpool are going to be looking to be selling anyone on the cheap. I think they will drive a hard bargain, as they usually do. But I think if they can find a buyer for Wilson, he's another one who might have played his last game for Liverpool.
One of the guys that we is hotly debated kind of in this group, and Els, I'll come to you, It is Mr. Naby Keita, as Paul mentioned kind of earlier on, up here as well. This will be his fourth season now, I believe. He'll be heading into his fourth season at Liverpool. He's not really made the landmark impact that we all expected from the guy that we've signed a year in advance from Leipzig. Obviously, various issues with injuries that have kind of derailed his Liverpool career so far. We can definitely see the bright sparks. We've not just seen it in a consistent spell, really. Do you think he's one of the players, Els, for you, that Liverpool should possibly be looking to try and move on this summer?
Ordinarily, I would say yeah. I would say yeah, because he's still at a good age. You can still get in a decent amount for him. But at the same time, like you said, we know he has quality. You don't want to lose too many quality players. We've lost Gini already. We don't want to lose another quality player, Naby Keita, in our midfield. So I would personally say this is the last chance to loan him and Ox. This is the last chance. This is literally the last chance you can show us that you can do something. If not, boy, kick racks. But yeah, to be fair.
Sorry, how many chances are we going to give him? I have to be honest, like, and I love their profile, so I love Matip's profile, I love Kate's profile, but yeah, it's frustrating to me because we're having to rely on these players every season. So every season we go into like a campaign saying, okay, we've got Naby Keita, we've got so and so that's got depth, but where are they when it comes to the crucial points? We can't rely on them, you know what I'm saying? I'd rather get players in who probably not have got the same quality, but at least we can rely on them. At least they're fit. You know what I'm saying?
It's frustrating.
I'm of the opinion that I'd rather get a player in who's more reliable. Maybe not the same as quality as him, but just more reliable, really.
Yeah, and I think that's where it is. And I think that's the frustrating thing is, like, for instance, someone like Gini frustrated me a lot, but I knew that, yeah, he's going to play and he's still a quality player. And when he's on the team sheet, when his name's on the T-sheet, it fills us with a bit of confidence because we have a top player playing. Someone like Naby, who's got all this ability, he came to the club with a lot of fanfare. I remember on Twitter that like, people were saying he's going to displace Henderson, this, that, and the third. And unfortunately, he couldn't. He's nowhere to be seen. So for me personally, because of the quality that he does possess and the type of ability he does have, I mean, if you have like someone like Thiago and Naby and Fabinho in the midfield, it's very tantalising. And these are players that beat players for fun and they try to do things. So that's a prospect that you do think about. But again, can he be available? I mean, what's the point of having someone like that and he plays less than a third of the season? And when you're trying to go for trophies and you're trying to win things, you've got a player like that who's just is a hindrance. So again, if you're asking me, I'll probably give him one more year. If he can't play at least 30 games. Boy.
Biggie, yeah. Give me one more chance. Paul, I'll come to you kind of on the Keita topic. It's no secret that the manager obviously rates him fairly highly. I mean, he played him away in the game against Real Madrid in the first leg, albeit kind of didn't work out particularly well. And we know that the manager obviously has beliefs in his quality and what he can bring to the team. But do you think for Liverpool, obviously, he's got 2 years left on his contract now as well. He's on a fairly sizable amount of money. Do you think if a decent offer did come in for Keita this season, let's just say Borussia Dortmund come in with £35 million for him, do you think Klopp, Edwards and the rest of the guys would kind of sit there and contemplate selling the player to kind of fund some other transfers that they might be looking to make?
I think Michael Edwards would book a flight for him if Dortmund offer £35 million. Do you know what's interesting with Keita is fans and media and everyone, they've been having the same debate, haven't they, for 4 years, 3 years. Yeah. It is just great player, but we can't get him on the pitch. I think it's probably time to cut the losses if there is a team interested. I don't know if there is. I think with it being a very strange transfer market this summer, I think he might be a kind of too much of a pricey asset for teams in Germany who don't typically pay huge fees, do they? I mean, he's probably shown. I've seen this on Twitter actually, and when I seen it, I thought, yeah, do you know what? I completely agree with that. He's probably RB Leipzig's greatest ever player, isn't he? When you think that this is a club we were only established in 2009, so they would probably love to have him back, wouldn't he? But as you say, whether Liverpool are willing to take X amount of losses on a player who cost them £52 million, I'm not sure, but. The interesting thing for me was when he played in Madrid and he got brought off after like 43 minutes. And
we never saw him again.
Yeah, exactly. At the time, you're thinking, well, that's Keita. He's probably injured, isn't he? But Klopp said after the game, you know, we got asked what was up with Keita. And he said, oh, no, it's just a tactical decision. So to bring the player off 2 minutes before half-time when the team's really struggling, it was almost a massive kind of, I mean, I didn't necessarily agree with it. I thought it was a bit harsh. It was almost just like a pointing the finger. This is where we've gone wrong. You're getting the hook because you are the shocker. If you'd have sucked them at half time, no one would have batted as much of an eyelid, if you know what I mean, if that makes sense.
Paul, mate, he was struggling, brother. He was killing us, mate. He was having us in a blender. He was killing Trent. He had to come off.
I agree he didn't have a good game at all, but I thought it was harsh to kind of single him out before half time. He could have easily two more minutes and just brought him off for half time. I mean, it's the right thing because he didn't play well at all. And it's interesting that he hasn't been seen since. So I think maybe the patience has run out with Jürgen Klopp on Naby Keita. And as you say, if Dortmund, you know, hypothetically offered that this summer, I think he would be off. But I don't think that will be the case.
The hypothetical Dortmund situation, indeed. I feel like a really weird, a nice situation for him to possibly be in would be maybe be Atletico Madrid. Obviously, we've kind of seen what they're doing. And, you know, there's talk of obviously Saul leaving the club. League champions have a little bit of money behind their back. Might be a nice signing for them. I'm kind of willing this into existence more than anything, as opposed to hearing anything tangible. But yeah, I completely agree with everything you said there. I think if a sizable offer does come in, I think you have to you just do have to kind of take it, really, because if there's one thing the season has shown, and obviously from our one idle discussion, is that availability is one of the best qualities you can have in the squad at the moment, especially when we are lacking one thing from midfield, and that's goals and assists and a little bit of a creative spark. Paul, actually, I'll come back to you on this. We've kind of detailed this summer, and to a lesser extent the summer before, as kind of the summer of opportunity in terms of, you know, some of the talent that might be available to sign. You kind of look at, you know, Jadon Sancho's last season, Kai Havertz, Jude Bellingham, etc. The club seemed a little bit reluctant to kind of make an investment for one of these generational talents that are possibly on the market. Is it any kind of indication as to why that is? Is it just a price issue? And I guess kind of seeing me on the back of that, can you understand some of the frustration fans might have when the club kind of seemingly don't want to kind of when we're in the position that we're in, you know, fresh off winning the league, winning the Champions League, the club kind of don't want to take that next step and sign one of these generational talents to keep the party going, as it were.
I think they've been really unlucky with the pandemic. I think they were ideally positioned. You know, when you look back to March 2020, Liverpool, they had the Nike deal on the horizon and they had a squad full of elite players and looked like they were really going to kind of push on and cement a legacy and be a little bit of a new Liverpool dynasty. And then the pandemic happened and, you know, Liverpool have had no match day income since, you know, 18 months, and Liverpool earn about £3 million per home game. They've lost about £120 million as a result of the pandemic, and they're not a football club who are backed by a sugar daddy you can just write off, you know, X amount of losses. It's very much cut your cloth accordingly, and people don't want to hear it, but it's obviously the way that Fenway Sports Group work, and for so long it has put them in good stead, hasn't it? I mean, I can understand the frustrations, that I really can, but the financial realities of it all mean that they're probably never going to be in the hunt for players who are upwards of 100 million plus. I mean, Liverpool as a football club have never been that way anyway. If you look at some of their greatest players in history, they were never brought to Anfield as the superstars, really. I mean, you know, even going back from Kenny Dalglish's days when he replaced Kevin Keegan and Robbie Fowler come through the academy and anyone you want to name. Fernando Torres was a little bit different, wasn't he? He kind of was almost a bit of a ready-made star. But Liverpool have never been a club who pay what Manchester United do, for example, in wages and fees. And certainly Chelsea over the last 15, close to 20 years now, isn't it? In City, they just buy 50, 60 million players by the dozen. So, look, I understand why fans are frustrated, but just the way Liverpool have always operated, and certainly with the current ownership, they're not a group who can necessarily match the likes of Chelsea and Man City for fees. So I think they'll continue to box clever with the recruitment team that they've got and continue to kind of pull up a few gems here or there. I mean, I think there's a case to be made that Thiago was probably the most high-profile player that Liverpool have ever bought. He's only played for two other clubs, Barcelona and Bayern Munich, and he's one of the most decorated players of the last 10 years. And he was kind of a little bit of an opportunistic buy because his contract was up and he wanted a fresh challenge. So it's just not Liverpool's way of operating. So I can't see them ever being in the mixer for a Kylian Mbappe, sadly, as much as we'd all love to see him at Anfield. Certainly not while he's a... You know, PSG don't have to sell, and he's probably valued at 200 million.
Sir Paul, you've literally just crushed Ellis's heart there. I try to tell Ellis this every day. But look, they get Mbappe.
I said it's possible. If they swing around some numbers, if they wanted to do it, they could. But it's a possibility. But I've always been on opinion that, like you said, Paul, we've never done that. We've never ever bought a superstar. So I don't know why fans decided they won the super. We've never done it. Even Suarez, he wasn't a superstar. He was, again, a player that was on the ascendancy. I hope Mike Edwards still has a spreadsheet of Suarez, because we need someone like that. But but yeah, all the players that we bought, Alonso, Mascherano, these were all players that were on the ascendancy of being a superstar. We've never actually gone out and said that, we're going to buy a superstar. I just think because we're in a position where we've won the league, we've won the Champions League. Obviously, fans believe that we should be eating at that table. But if something works, why would you change it? Is my always opinion. And the ball's in FSG's court, because this is what's working for them and this is what has brought them success. And again, I believe that it's a very good template, because there's been names we've been linked with. There's young players that are coming up that us, the fans, don't really know, but they're on the cusp of being a top player. Was linked with the striker in Fiorentina. What's his name, Chris?
Dusan Vlahovic.
Yeah, that's another player. who's on the cusp, not many people that. So those are the type of signings that I feel that Liverpool make, and yeah,
they'll make them. I think the interesting thing is the FSG deal with Redbird, which is I think it was in April now that was agreed. It was basically 10% of the FSG portfolio for 540 million. And when it happened, I was speaking to a couple of people around the club, and they were telling me, they actually said, you know, over the phone, it doesn't mean we're going to be buying Kylian Mbappe. To which I laughed, and I said, well, you know, I've had to shoot that one down a few times anyway. But what stressed was it was very much business as usual. So the idea that Liverpool are kind of swimming upstream with the pandemic is kind of being offset massively by this income. And business as usual was the phrase I heard quite a lot. So it just meant that Liverpool were going to be able to compete as they normally would. So it wasn't kind of a massive influx of cash that was going to mean that they were going to be able to go and, you know, compete for the best players in the world. But you know, on the other flip side, it didn't mean that they were going to be unable to buy anyone at all. So I think we've already seen that this summer with Ibrahim Konate, you know, a young player, as Elle said, you know, a young player, you know, on the rise. And I think that's kind of the profile that we're going to be seeing more of this summer and you know, possibly the next couple of summers.
Sorry, Paul. We're saying that with the investment from Red Bull, would you think some of that money that they invest will be offsetting onto the contracts? Because I know you said we're going to try and get the contracts away. So putting two one and one together, it seems like some of that money is going to go into the contracts. Would you think that's the case?
Yeah, definitely. I think some of it was kind of money that was owed. Because as I say, Liverpool have lost so far around about 120 million as a result of the pandemic, which is, you know, the price of Jadon Sancho, maybe a little bit less than Erling Haaland. But yes, some of that was kind of offset that, and I would imagine it would be, you know, money reserved for the contracts as well. Because while to fans it doesn't appear as though it's much of an outlay, I think when new contracts are drawn up and signed, it's signing on fees and often it's an increase in salary and bonuses and whatnot. So, yeah, I think definitely that is where some of that money is going, definitely, yeah.
Paul, I'll kind of put the question back to you as well. You know, we're talking about kind of Sancho's, Havertz, Bellingham's, etc. We're kind of seeing there's like the up-and-coming, the next big thing, as it were, the Brock Lesnar of football. Does that not kind of fit within the FSG model? You buy a gem of a player at a younger age, you've got them kind of, I guess, under cost control realistically for the length of their contract. You know, with how transfers are, I think a lot of people don't kind of understand that you're not paying the one sum kind of upfront. It's, you know, a percentage of the fee over the course of the contract with add-ons and stuff as well. Do you find it a little bit weird in terms of obviously FSG American background where they get cost control over younger assets? And obviously Liverpool kind of looking to unearth a next star. Do you think it's a little bit odd that they've not kind of... obviously you can kind of tell us if they've had conversations for these players. Do you think it's weird that they've not made a concerted effort to kind of go into the market and drive hard for one of them?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that the Bellingham one is an interesting one, isn't it? Because Liverpool brought a lad from Birmingham in December, Callum Scanlon. I think he's a 15-year-old lad. Kate Gordon from Derby, who obviously already made his championship debut. They are always on the lookout for the next rising stars. And Jude Bellingham was probably the biggest star in the galaxy, wasn't he, when you're looking at players under the age of 18 in English football?
Yeah, you don't get your shirt retired at Birmingham City for no reason.
Exactly. Crazy, isn't it? So he's obviously made that jump from Birmingham to Dortmund. And Dortmund have obviously got a reputation for giving young players a chance, and he goes straight into the first team with them. And we've seen Jadon Sancho kind of make, you know, his name at that Dortmund. Liverpool were kind of aware of Sancho while he was at Manchester City, but there was always the acceptance that they're never going to be able to prize him away from a rival at the time. So he went to Dortmund and has made himself an England international on the back of it. So it's a difficult one, isn't it? There's so many variables at play, but yeah, in the case of Bellingham, who you mentioned there in particular, it was peculiar why Liverpool's interest wasn't more widely, you know, known. People will have been obviously looking at him at some point, but you know, when you can play first team in the Bundesliga every week for second biggest club in Germany, it's probably quite a tempting offer, isn't it, for a young player?
Completely agree. I know a lot of people kind of like to use the, well, why did they sign Minamino as opposed to Haaland as a bit of an example. But I think what a lot of people have to kind of understand is when you pay that fee for Erling Haaland, we know now that there's a release clause that is active from next season. So you're going to lose that player at some point. And you are under the pretty much the mercy of Mino Raiola as well. So there's two specific headaches that you don't really want to deal with there. So it makes complete sense. And Paul as well, I want to stick on transfers. Last one, I promise. You had a really good column in your blood red column this week as well. Obviously focused on Michael Edwards. We kind of touched on it a little bit earlier on, but do you see this as another window where he needs to be shrewd with the relationships that he's got kind of built up in world football? Obviously, like we saw, Liverpool have got a really good working relationship with the Red Bull group in general, that kind of helped with that Konate signing, obviously Minamino before that, etc. And of course, along with his no fabled data scouting model. Do you think that Liverpool will kind of rely heavily on that again to, like we said, unearth some of these gems that might be available kind of this summer? And is there any specific names that you think we should maybe be on the lookout for with Liverpool to be linked with?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a key thing. It's kind of an unseen thing, isn't it, with football fans who maybe kind of get a little bit of a football manager thing of how transfers work, where you just go to a club and tell them, ring them up and say, listen, we've got X amount of money for the player, why can we get him? It's all about relationships, and Michael Edwards has proven himself to be so adept at building those over the last few years with the Red Bull group. As you mentioned, Liverpool have signed obviously Minamino, Keita and Konate off the back of that relationship, and in all likelihood would have got Timo Werner had it not been for the pandemic and the realisation that 50 million was probably better spent elsewhere last year. It's going to be a continuation of that theme. Liverpool or Edwards rather built up a good relationship with Fabinho's representatives, who also represent Jota and Gesta Fute, I think they're called. Probably butchered that Portuguese pronunciation of that. But yeah, it's all about relationships. And Michael Edwards over the past few years has basically got a sprawling network of contacts throughout European football. And as you mentioned there, Chris, about the data model with Ian Watkins and his team, you know, the data nerds, as they're sometimes unfairly labelled, they are the kind of science side of player recruitment, to no stone left unturned, kind of exhausting the numbers and then seeing, you know, whittling down a shortlist. And the interesting thing for Liverpool is the way they've gone about transfers in recent times is very much focus on a shortlist rather than focus on, you know, you mentioned there should be any names who you should be aware of, but it's very much a shortlist for positions. So when you were after a left-back last summer, it was Kostas Tsimikas, Jamal Lewis, Sergi Reguilon, and someone else on that list. Kostas Tsimikas, who he obviously signed. And then for Jota, it was Jonathan David, who went to Lille, and Ismail Assar at Watford, when they were looking for that kind of wide forward position. So it's very much a case of whittling down the numbers and the scouting reports, and you know, your feedback from various places, and then Liverpool kind of essentially try and go after them all and see what happens. I know that's kind of what they did for Lewis and Tsimikas, and it's what they did with Saar and Jota as well. So I think it's a very fluid transfer market, and Liverpool's way of operating is kind of that way. So it's difficult to nail down bona fide targets when there's a shortlist that they're working off and they're trying to work it out themselves. It's very tough. But I think there'll be a forward coming in at some point. Not too sure on names at the moment. But yeah, I would be shocked if Liverpool didn't sign a kind of another versatile forward who can operate across the front.
No, watch this space and stay tuned to the Liverpool Echo for more info on that. Just want a quick round robin, really. What's the one opposition move you'd be all terrified to see happen this summer? Ellis, I'll start with you.
Well, if anyone can get him out, I'm not joking. if Kane went to, yeah, I think Kane going to Man City, that would be a bit scary. No, well, Man City beat everyone. No, sorry, scrap that. Haaland going to Chelsea, that would be a bit scary. Yeah, that would
terrify
me.
Pete?
Do you know what? This one is more, it doesn't scare me. I just think it ruins the game of football. So my favourite footballer to watch that's not an LFC player is Jack Grealish. Right? It's Jack Grealish. Like, how can you? Yeah, I'm saying Jack Grealish, what a baller. Like, the way he goes past players, beats players for fun, they find him, they can't get near him. His hair's flicking under that underband that he wears. You know what I'm saying? What guy? And then if he goes to Man City, it just ruins football. It ruins it for me. You know what I'm saying? It ruins it. So, Grealish going to Man City, I think, yeah, that will, I would hate that. You know what I'm saying? I love watching him play. Like, yeah, I love watching him play. So, yeah, Grealish going to Man City for me.
The beautiful game. Let's keep it that way. Paul, how about yourself?
Do you know what? All three of those suggestions are all spot on. I love Grealish. You know, socks roll down, hair flicking, beats a man, gets kicked more than anyone, the poor lad. He must get absolutely sick to the backseat of it. So if he went to City or United, I wouldn't like to see that. I think the one that would scare me the most is Kane going to City, because he's just an absolute goal machine, isn't he? And kept Tottenham, you know, treading water, hasn't he, for years, just from his goals alone. So if he went to City, he's going to score 30, 40 goals without doubt, and he's kind of the natural successor for Aguero. So that would be the one for me that would worry me.
Nah, I think you've all given good answers there, from both an opposition perspective and just a football perspective, really. I think the Kane one's interesting because I've seen some of the stadiums that are in this Europa Conference League, and thank God that we didn't finish in it, because there was one where an airport is on the back of the stadium. So one ball that goes over the stadium is causing a fair few flight delays.
Do you see the train station that was around the pitch? There was like a little train going around the pitch. I'm not sure you saw that. I was on tour, but yeah. It was
really?
Yeah, the train the train sort of rack going around the pitch.
Abolish that competition. I don't get the point of like the top few leagues being in it, in all honesty. I think obviously UEFA wanted to make it a bit more of an open competition. They want to get more nations involved. I don't get why you'd open it to the eighth or the seventh best team in England, to be honest with you, because more than likely it'll possibly be either Spurs or Roma that will be winning it at the end of the day. This has been a really fun pod. Paul, thank you very much for joining. Before we do close off, big hip hop fan, big rap fan. It's one of the reasons why we love having you on the pod, in all honesty. we want to know, and me specifically, what's been on your Spotify playlist in the past 12 months?
Do you know what? When I seen the rundown of the show today, I was looking forward to this bit the most. I thought we can get stuck into this bit. So I was last on, was it August last year, was it?
It was, yeah.
Yeah. So Run the Jewels 4 came out around that time, so that was one that was heavily in rotation. And I think Nas, King's Disease, come out, didn't it, around that time?
Quality album.
Yeah. Hip Boy just had an incredible year, hasn't he? Crocodile, Joel Ortiz, Hard. That was a good one. Get Your Money was probably one of my favourite tunes as well of last year. Eminem, the legendary Eminem. But you know what was probably my favourite album? And I was actually, because I knew I was coming on this just before I come on, I was giving it a listen as I was doing the dishes. Benny the Butcher's album.
Yes.
That's brilliant from you, Paul. Absolutely fantastic, mate.
You are aware now that we're going to have to enshrine you in the Cop End Hall of Fame. Forget the Premier League Hall of Fame. You're in the Cop End Hall of Fame now, Paul.
I aspire to be. And then at the moment, I'm listening to the new Lloyd Banks and Pete Rosenberg just brought out a compilation album, hasn't he? So. Listening to them the last few days. I haven't formed an opinion on either of those yet. Need to give them a few more listens.
Lloyd Banks' album is really good. I think the one thing he's lacking on there is just the production aspect, in all honesty. But you know, with the PLK, you're going to get bars guaranteed. I did see I did see, whilst I did some research and prep for the show, that you're a big fan of Pusha T's last album, Daytona.
What was your favorite?
It's one of the best albums I've ever heard. What would you say your best? What would you say your favorite track off that one is?
Oh, Santa Maria, All Day. It's just not long enough.
True, I completely agree.
3 minutes of. It's that little same sample as Little Kim, isn't it? With Biggie. It's been used a few times as well. I think Dr. Dre Explosive is possibly the same sample. Yeah, that for me was probably the best one. But you know what? I loved all those good music albums where they were only seven tracks long and they were released a week apart for like 6 weeks or whatever. Thought that was a good little concept. But yeah, I love Pusha T. I was meant to see him a few years ago in Park Life and it never ended up going for whatever reason, and he's someone I'd love to tick off.
We'll have to make sure that he does a tour soon, so you can definitely get to see him live. But no, Paul, as always, we really appreciate you coming on and Cop End. Always a good time to have you on. Tell the people where they can find you on Twitter if they don't know already.
Yeah, it's at PT Ghost at LFC. The Live Echo LFC is obviously the Echo's Twitter account, so follow those two, and we'll keep it up to date with all of the transfer rumours and try and separate the fact from fiction.
Love it. Yeah, you're not going to get any ITK nonsense from Mr. Ghost, that is for sure. If you love what you've heard today on Cop End, then please do head over to our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/copenfracas, and from as little as £3 a month, you'll get access to a wealth of content which you can enjoy at any time. And we've got between you and I, listener, we've got a lot of stuff coming within the next few weeks. We did our content plan last week. Whew, you are in for a treat, and just from £3 a month, you'll be getting a bargain. So do head over there and subscribe today. But that has been your episode of Cop End Fracas for this week. I'm your host, Chris. I've been joined by Ellis, Peter, and the immortal Paul Ghost. Until next week, we'll see you soon.
Thank you.
Sports Social Podcast Network.